the Harmony. Then, this is our 32nd week now, and second week, though, that the location is somewhere in the immediate vicinity of the Benaiah, as it's called today in Israel, that you see on the screen right here. Last week showed you several pictures, spent a lot more time on that, but this was the location of a great deal of idolatry. The cave that you see back here was referred to at that time as the Gates of Hades. They were in this immediate vicinity, though not necessarily on this site, within a mile or two, let's say, certainly, or maybe at the very foot of the cave, I don't know, when Peter recognized who Jesus was. Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus praised him for that. Jesus said that the Father had revealed this to him. And we were told then as well that upon this rock, that is the statement, not Peter, that Jesus would build his church and the gates of Hades would not prevail against it. And so it's apparent that Jesus was making a play on this location as he was in the region and very directly then addressing the idolatry of the people of that time, demonstrating there he was stronger, even death itself would not be able to prevent him from building his kingdom, nor would it be able ever to destroy that kingdom. Of course, two millenniums later, here we are, that kingdom endures, filled the earth, and will continue to do so. It is absolutely indestructible. So this is the general location where we are. Last week I had mentioned these springs of the Jordan River. I didn't show you so many pictures of those. There's just a massive amount of water flowing directly out of the cliff foot right there. That is one of the sources, or three, of the Jordan River itself. Now, don't turn, but in the second chapter of the book of Acts, we have a really interesting event. I think profoundly important for all Bible students who cannot read Greek. What happens in Acts chapter 2 is that this, as Jesus has risen from the dead, he's returned to heaven, he's promised the Holy Spirit for the 12 apostles. He did not promise that baptism of the Holy Spirit to anybody else, only to them. They're the only ones that receive it in Acts chapter 2. But in Acts chapter 2, we have a list of some 17 different nations that are represented. Now, it says there are Jews from all these nations, so the audience is Jewish, but they come into town for the Passover and the subsequent Pentecost. They are in huge numbers, perhaps as many as a million people that come into that town. 17 nations are named from which these Jews have come to be present for these great feast days. These Jews have learned those languages. And many of them, generation after generation, were born in those countries. And while their parents and grandparents, you know, were Jews, they're really native speakers of 15 different languages. 17 nations named, but there's 15 different languages that they represent. So what is the first thing that takes place? This great miracle, which is amazing to people and allows them all to be able to listen to the sermons that are presented there because they're being presented in their native tongues. That's the miracle. The apostles suddenly speaking languages they've never studied is a miracle of translation. Instantly, the very first sermon ever preached was translated into 15 different languages. So, is it okay for you to have a different translation on your lap than the person next to you? Well, sure. And through the years, as English changes, is it okay to translate the original Bible in its Greek, New Testament, you know, into languages? Well, of course we can. Okay? However, if all languages represented concepts and ideas exactly the same, it'd be pretty easy. The reason we have so many translations is what? They don't. Even in English, we have, a surprisingly, as languages go, a large number of words in our vocabulary, an extremely useful language that we speak because it has such a marvelous range of words to pick from, subtle differences, to try and represent something. So, there are translation differences and difficulties. Now, your unbeliever, of course, attacks the Bible on this level, when in fact, it's exactly what God's been doing from the beginning. It's really rather quite helpful. When you compare the different translation ideas, you're getting closer to the original idea, not farther. It's not an element of distrust for your Bible, quite exactly the opposite. But occasionally, we do have to stop, and it's really not very often, we do have to stop and say, you know, here, there's a problem. The translators had some difficulties here that create problems in a proper understanding. Very seldom, but occasionally, a little bit of a knowledge of the Greek will help. Now, last week we closed on page 117 with one of those places. I promise you this week I'd start the class dealing with it a little more fully. So this time, while we used Mark 8 on page 117 as our basic text last week, we're going to use Luke 9 here this morning. Now, the great beauty, of course, of harmonies is arranging Gospels side by side so you can get the full record of it and compare the differences in the various way that the Spirit selects to reveal this information to each one of the Gospel writers. So let's look at Luke's account, chapter 9. And there at the bottom on page 117, verse 23, Jesus was saying to them all, "If anyone wishes to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me." Now you all know, and everybody knows, it's the easiest thing to understand that passage. When Jesus, to those people at that time, says, take up your cross, what is he referring to? The Roman invention and gruesome, grisly habit of torturing people to death, often, you know, with no semblance of justice, on a cross. Crucifixion is the word. Crucifixions are performed by the tens of thousands by the Romans in this city of Jerusalem, in environs of Israel, and then throughout the Roman Empire. To find somebody who has not witnessed the crucifixion in that time would be difficult. And as a matter of fact, to make their point, these crucifixions, the Romans, would line the main streets in Jerusalem with miles of crucified Jews that you had to walk through to get to Jerusalem for instance, the Pentecost you read about in Acts chapter 2. Now, going through, you know, all of this morning, because in that verse, we know what he's talking about. And brethren, when a person is crucified, what do they lose? Do they lose their souls, that immortal part of them that will return? Is that what they lose on the cross? Does anybody ever think of a soul being lost on a cross? You never. So in the context, as we get into what is about to become a translation problem, in the context, we know exactly what we're talking about. Jesus is saying, following me is worth the loss of your life. Following me is worth the loss of anything, up to and including your life. You need to expect that there's going to be physical suffering up to and including death itself if you're going to be following me. So he was saying to them all, if anyone wishes to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. Jesus was not the first one to have to bear his cross to the place of death. The Romans did this. It was the standard procedure. Take up your cross and follow me is a well-known and terrifyingly powerful picture for everybody that's listening to Jesus ever utter these words. Then comes verse 24. For whoever wishes to save his soul shall lose it. Now, to my knowledge, there's not a single translation anywhere that says that. What do you have on your page? Whoever wishes to save his what? Life is the way it's translated. But whoever loses his what for my sake, as the verse continues? Life, he is the one who will save it. For what is a man profited if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits what? Himself. And we start with Luke here this morning. Very helpful. Because Luke doesn't even touch the translation problem. Luke's record has Jesus, or he records rather, something Jesus also said. But over here in Matthew and Mark, we have what Jesus also said, an elaboration upon it, if you will, that creates a kind of a translation difficulty. So this time, go back to the bottom of page 117, in the left-hand column in Matthew chapter 16, verse 25. Whoever wishes to save his what? Life shall lose it, but whoever loses his what? Life, for my sake, shall find it. Follow immediately on verse 24. Take up his cross and follow me. What is at risk? Life. So, brethren, there's no problem. Everybody in verse 25 of Matthew, everybody in verse 35 in Mark 8, all the translators in Luke chapter 9, verse 24, everybody says life, because the Greek word means life. But you turn the page to page 118. Luke just says loses or forfeits himself. But Matthew, verse 26, in the left-hand column said, or recorded what Jesus said, what will a man be profited if he gains the whole world and forfeits his, what do you have? How many have soul? Raise your hand if you got soul. It's two-thirds, three-quarters of the audience. Do you have a footnote? Well, sure you do. So, and if you look at the footnote here, forget the footnote.
I've derailed here.
Yeah, it says soul. Yeah, or soul. Not helping us here in this case because it already is soul. It says soul both times. And so what that is, this is going to be hard for you to believe. The footnote is incorrect because they messed up. It's a printing error. Okay, what does the text say? Soul. Then you have a footnote, number four. You go look at number four, and what does it say? Or, and gives you what?
No.
The exact same words.
But it also goes back to the other verses because the lives are donated in the four also. It's saying soul in all of it.
From the previous page. See, that's right. That's why I say it's poor printing, man. Let's put it that way. Here's the deal. In Greek, look it up in any Greek lexicon, any Greek dictionary, you know, I've studied Greek 5 years, nobody argues about this. That one Greek word can be translated soul. The question is, if you have four uses of one word in two adjoining verses, should you translate it two different ways, knowing that English readers have a tremendous difference in their minds between the loss of a life and the loss of a soul? Okay? Now, I'm suggesting, brethren, that's very poor translation that would do that. And I think everybody knows why. Verse 25 in Matthew 16 follows verse 24. Verse 35 in Mark 8 follows verse 34. Verse 24 in Luke 9 follows verse 23. So when you're in verse 24, there isn't any doubt whatsoever. Everybody knows you're talking about a life. Everybody translates life. But when you turn the page in this case, and you look at these others, the problem here is that we have biases, and so do translators. And they're not doing anything illegal. They're not doing anything dishonest. They're not trying to do, you know, any wool pulling. They're trying to get to the idea. But nobody is able to totally divorce themselves from their doctrinal views and positions. And so when you're translating from the Greek, you use the context to help you translate properly. In the preceding verse, everybody translates life because that clearly is what we're talking about. Nobody has any doctrinal differences. But in Matthew 16:26, at the very top of page 118, what will a man be profited if he gains the whole world and forfeits his life? Or what will a man give in exchange for his life. Reads oddly to most of us, because in most churches, virtually all churches, this verse has been interpreted to refer to a final judgment and losing not your life to human beings, but losing your eternal soul to God in judgment. And because that's our viewpoint of what we think the verse is talking about, then, for many people, the translators put soul because they're so sure that that's what Jesus is talking about. When they see these two equal ways to translate the one word, they think, well, I know what I believe Jesus is saying, so I'm putting soul down there because that's what I think he's talking about. Then they have a footnote from the previous page, going back as Ron properly described. But the point here is that one Greek word can be translated two different ways. But it's used four times in two adjoining verses. And it ought to be translated with only one word. So as I pointed out last week, close the class this way. Pick soul if you want. And then think about all those verses. What did Jesus mean if Jesus said soul in the sense that we English speakers think of the word soul? Then you go back and you see one single word in the Greek, translate it uniformly to life, and do exactly the same thing. What is the idea that Jesus was imparting if the better translation is life four times in two adjoining verses? Now, I've been looking at this problem for a lot of years, and I know everybody has, and brethren, I'm very, very emphatically convinced that life in this context is the far better translation. The earlier verse about following me, taking up your cross, has that concept been abandoned? When you move from the verse that immediately followed it to the one that immediately follows that, did Jesus change the subject between those two verses? Did he go from physical life to eternal soul in Matthew 16 between verse 25 and verse 26? Absolutely not. In that, at least, there's no contextual reason to think so. It's the same Greek word. So what do you suppose we ought to do in English? Use a same word. Take one or the other, but stick with it because that's what God did in the Greek. Life is the better idea. The carrying of your cross is influencing both of these verses. And so now let's read it that way, everybody, on page 117. This time, since Luke didn't address it, let's go over to Matthew. Matthew 16, 25. Whoever wishes to save his life shall lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake shall find it. For what will a man be profited if he gains the whole world and forfeits his life? Or what will a man give in exchange for his life? Makes perfect sense, doesn't it? If you think about it for a second. And I just love this illustration. I do it every time. You know, I teach this class. Jerry's in the very back there. You know, he's trying to handle the sound system and everything. How's it going? Okay. Jerry, I'm going to give you the whole world. The only thing I ask is I put a bullet in your head. So what would it profit if I give you the whole world and you lose your life? What do you got? You've got nothing, brethren. Jerry, what would you give in exchange for your life? Would you give up your house? You'd give up most things, wouldn't you? Brethren, so this is one of those tragic places where hundreds of years ago, translators got into this rut of picking two different English words in two adjoining verses. That's just wrong. Not that they meant to do you wrong, not that they were trying to mislead you, they just could not get over their assumptions about what Jesus was talking about. Now please notice, there's a following verse. In Matthew's column, while we've got coming of the Son of Man and judgment near Caesarea Philippi, section 120, lots of blank spaces and all that, doesn't it go from verse 26 to verse 27? Well, sure. Well, what's the next thing he said? For, F-O-R, the Son of Man is going to come in the glory of his Father with his angels and will then recompense every man according to his deeds. Well, Larry, I'm absolutely certain you have to be wrong, because that's why we translate soul. Son of Man coming is a phrase that exclusively refers to the end of the world, doesn't it? No. No. But, particularly in the denominational world, particularly among premillennialists, you have this idea that that's what that phrase means. It does not. You know what? There's another verse that comes next. What's after that? Let's get the whole context. Verse 28. Truly I say to you, there are some of those who are standing here who shall not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his what? Now, brethren, we began with, there's nothing more important than the kingdom. You should take up your cross and follow me. Okay? What do you gain if you lose, but to get the whole world? And then he says, I'm coming in judgment. You're thinking about, what am I gaining and what's the price and should I carry that cross? And then he says in verse 28, truly I say to you, some of those who are standing here shall not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming. Now the assumption in verse 27 is that the Son of Man coming has to be the end of the world. But verse 28 puts a time stamp on when that coming takes place. When will that coming take place? While some of those people are still living. Did the end of the world come then? No. And what were the Christians immediately plunged into as soon as they became Christians in the first century, from next three on, what happened? What were they facing? Persecution, up to and including, only four chapters later, in chapter 7, death. Who gets killed? Stephen does. What's the rest of the book about? Chapter 8 opens up. Persecution widespread. People fleeing for their lives. What did Jesus tell them to expect? It's fulfilled. So, brother, really, there's no doubt about it. The mistake is assuming, in verse 27, that the coming of the Son of Man must refer to the end of the world. And then putting that idea back in the verse before it and ignoring entirely the verse that comes after it. Now, I did not grow up with parents who were Christians. I never saw anybody in a Church of Christ, never saw the sign until I was 21 years old. Okay? I don't have that background. But it's been a long time since 1973 when I was baptized in that church, and I started hearing the doctrines that prevail among us. And what I discovered was that Mark was the gospel that was almost exclusively used among us when our preachers and teachers, they were in my early formative years as a Christian, were talking about this time that Jesus said these things there by Caesarea Philippi. They used Mark. So, look in Mark's column. The top of the page, 118. What does it profit a man to gain the whole world, forfeit his soul? What shall a man give in exchange for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words and this adulterous and sinful generation, there's that time stamp, will also be ashamed of him when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. Well, of course, that's at least 2,000 years away. And then what do you notice about the bold print numeral that's in front of the next verse, the last one in that center column? What did they do with it? They made it bold. And did it go from verse 38 to verse 39? No, it went from verse 38 to what? Another chapter and verse 1. I picked up on this maybe 7 or 8 years after I'd become a Christian. It was very interesting. Look at that. In churches of Christ, Mark is the preferred text. and we stop reading at verse 38. And we act as if, since there's a chapter break there, then the statement in verse 1 doesn't go with the last verses in chapter 8. It's a new idea. Okay? How big a mistake is that when you're looking at Matthew's column? Whoa, it's huge. Did Jesus change location? Or is he still here by this water somewhere? Did Jesus change the sermon? Did he change the people he was talking to? Did anything change? No. He flowed directly into the timestamp. This is going to happen, my coming, before some of you standing here taste death. So, is it life or soul? It's life. What was he trying to teach them to do?
Be devoted to him and be willing to risk everything, including your life. Because if you trade, you know, the whole world for your life, you gain nothing. And what are you losing?
Your faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. Is it worth the trade? No, it's not. Now, is it a fact, if threatened by persecution, you give up your faith, is it not a fact that you'll never see heaven? See, that's true. In the final judgment, that is the end result.
The brethren is only one word, and he was preparing them in this moment for what they were next going to experience. Ongoing, long-term, most grievous persecution. That topic here starts with the cross, but it ends there too. It doesn't go on to a final judgment. So, enough on that. Excuse me, Carol, go ahead.
Greg.
Oh, I'm sorry. Somebody else had a question. Greg, yeah.
Okay, I think verse 24 is a little confusing to me.
Now, so, in which column?
Luke.
The Luke column now?
Yeah.
Okay.
For whoever wishes to save his physical life shall lose his physical life.
Uh-huh.
But whoever loses his physical life for my sake, he is the one who will save his physical life.
Yeah. I'm glad Greg asked, and it is a little more time I wanted to spend on this, but really it's fine. It's an excellent question. It's a good question. It's part of the translator's problem. You know, you're looking at that to, you know, what is all this about? Okay. Life is a word that can refer to the fact that I'm animated and I can think and walk around and talk. Okay? So, to use James' definition, the body apart from the spirit is what? Dead. So when we're talking about life, talking about when I die, it's because my spirit leaves. Okay? My body keels over. Right. Now, is there any other sense in which, in all languages, you can use the word life and it not only refers to just the fact that you're still moving around, but it also could refer to something else? Don and I married in December of 1975. In January of 76, we drove up I-5 right through here, and we went to the state of Washington. We then lived within about 40-mile spread from January of 1976 to July of 2012 when we moved here. And I've often said, my whole what changed? My whole life changed. What did I have to do? Don and I sold a house, and the best house I've ever owned. Don and I lost our two sons. They're now a five-hour drive away. We had, at the time, one grandchild. Now we've got three. So we had some familiarity with the first one. The second one was a quasi-stranger, and the third one, you know, just had a handful of hours next to what we used to have. So often I've said, I lost my whole what when I moved here? I lost my life. Did I die? Really wanted me to hit the floor, didn't I? Yeah. The new carpet, the pad, I almost was tempted.
Okay, lost my life. You know what else I've said? Coburg Road saved my life. That is a quote that I've spoken many, many times. Coburg Road saved my life. Because we were real unhappy with the previous church. And coming here was just a ginormous blessing. Enormous load was lifted. It was just heaven on earth. But was it heaven? And did I lose my soul? And did I gain a soul? No. I think that's what we're getting at here. Now, destruction of Jerusalem is what this is talking about, ultimately, by 70 AD. How many people are going to die if they don't leave Jerusalem when they see it surrounded by armies? Awful lot. Jesus is building to this. Now, did his kingdom come before these people died? Yes. Did they face persecution before these people died? Is this not the same generation? Eventually we'll get to Matthew 23 and 24, where that word generation is used there, and it refers to the people then living. Would they not, many of them, see Jerusalem fall? Yes. And starting in Acts 8, what did you have to do if you faced persecution? Flee for your life. What did you have to give up to save your life in Acts 8? Same way I did when Don and I left. You had to give up your life and flee to the Judean hills is the discussion in Matthew chapter 24. We'll get to that in due time. So, I think, you know, the biggest problem, everybody has this problem. It's not unique to us. It's not unique to denominational people. Brethren, it's hard to bridge 2,000 years and get back into their time frame. We don't know their language. We're not living in their, you know, circumstances. And so, that's what more advanced Bible study is, you know, is about. It's trying to say, well, what is the language saying? What does, you know, the Greek teach here? And what were the circumstances like? And then gathering all my Bible information about this generation and the things that are going to happen in this generation and what Jesus is talking about in Matthew 23. Believe me, we'll come back to this 16th chapter of Matthew when we get to Matthew 24. The comparisons are just identical. Okay? But not this morning. Okay, I'm doing Life of Christ here. So we'll leave it here. But you think about that, and then tonight, or this afternoon, you go home, you look at Matthew 24. You look at verse 34. All these things shall take place in what? This generation. And what was he telling them to do throughout Matthew 24? Flee the city. You're going to have to give up everything you own, give up your job, give up your everything, and flee to the Judean hills. So, that's the question. More on that in Matthew 24. Okay, so now we're on page, my book flopped shut, 118. We are. Just look at the last verse 28 again in Matthew's column. Truly I say to you, there are some of those who are standing here who shall not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Verse 27 said, the Son of Man is going to come in the glory of his Father with his angels, recompense every man according to his deeds. 26, 24, 23 are all talking, brethren, about the coming of that kingdom. And how are people judged when the kingdom was established in Acts 2 and throughout the following years of the book of Acts as the gospel is being preached? Is there a judgment when people in in Matthew 24 finally see the destruction of Jerusalem, the ruination of all things Jewish? You're either a Christian or you're in slavery or dead. See, all comes together in that event. And you're judged by whether or not you accept the words of Jesus Christ and you choose to give up your whole life to save your physical animated life by getting out of town because you believe what the Lord said. That's the context. And I know, you know, you have to wrestle with it some because that word soul's in there. Take it out, put life, and everything really come a lot clearer. Pick soul, work with that if you like, see what happens. Okay? You work the problem. Okay, now, a lot of time on that, but that's okay. Let's go then to the Transfiguration. And while we're turning to that, which actually is top of page 119, you know, have a look here for just a second Brother, we all know the term Mount of Transfiguration. We all know the events about to take place here. Nobody knows where it took place, though. And there are two very primary ideas. One of them is somewhere up among these hills and mountains that lead up to over 9,000 foot high Mount Hermon. Jesus is in Caesarea Philippi. I showed you that cliff face in the preceding picture there. Okay? Quite literally, there goes what? The hills. This is where the water comes out. Everything that you see, as you look to the north from there, is rising hills going up to Mount Hermon, which is 9,000 feet, before it's all over. It's all mountains from that point on. So all Jesus had to do was walk up the hill, and everywhere he went, to the north and to the east, is uphill. Could have stopped at any place. Here's just one, for instance. I don't know the elevation right here. Hermon itself is obscured in the distance behind those clouds. But, you know, perhaps it was here or here. The alternative is Mount Tabor. Mount Tabor is 57 miles from Caesarea Philippi. The pinnacle at 9,000 feet, well, actually the ski resort, which is where I like to go, the ski resort is 32 miles away. I doubt that Jesus had to go 32 miles clear up to the snow line to be up on a high mountain. But I also doubt that instead of, you know, just walking straight uphill, and he could have stopped at any one of 2, 3, 4, 5 miles, all the way to 32 miles, you know, that he would have turned to come south and gone to Mount Tabor. It doesn't seem quite as likely. But it is one of the ones that people suggest. This is a wonderful mountain, Tabor, as it sits in the midst of a valley that is 360 degrees. It's just like a volcanic rise. Very distinct and pronounced how it just sits out there all by itself. And so, from the top of here, the views are just astonishing. 360 degrees. You're just looking at one that's off toward the west there. But isn't that just amazing? And so maybe he was up on this mountain. We have no idea of the actual location. And no more slides. So let's close out today with Luke again as our standard text over on the right-hand column. However, get your pencils out, because what we're about to see right here is one of the most spectacular places in your whole study of the life of Christ, where the harmony really shines. Because Matthew gives pieces that Mark doesn't, and Mark says things that Luke doesn't, and Luke says things that neither one of them did, and there's a whole lot of them that are unique to each one. So if you'll take your pencil, what I'll do is I'll identify the unique words in each column, and you do like I did, it'll leap off the page later. But if you circle in your pencil each one of those unique things, then when you look at the page, I can tell you exactly what is unique to each one of those Gospels in an instant. So you all know the story in general. Let's put it all together by seeing all four Gospels at the same time. We're going to start with Luke 9:28, top of 119. Some 8 days after these sayings. Now, don't let it bother you that Mark said, how much later? How much later did Matthew say? So, 2 out of 3, Luke must be wrong. Okay, if you have a few hours on Monday, and all of Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and then you're back to another few hours, you'll be understanding, again, the society. Sometimes they only talk about the actual full days in between two events. Sometimes they'll speak of a few hours on either side as another whole day. There's absolutely no conflict between 6 days and some 8 days after these sayings. Just the difference between 6 full days and the parts that were on either side, it would be then 8 days. It came about that he took along, so circle 8 days. In Luke's column. The other two didn't say it that way. But it's exactly the same time frame. Came about that he took along Peter and John and James. He went up to the mountain to pray. And while he was praying, Luke's the only one that says that. So circle while he was praying. The other two don't mention that that's when this event took place. The appearance of his face became different, and his clothing became white and gleaming. So how descriptive is that in Luke's column? His face was different. Well, how is it different? Well, I don't know. He doesn't say. But what happened to his clothing? White and gleaming. So, circle, I'm not sure how to do this for sure, but I put, face became different, and I also circled, his clothing became white and gleaming. But then look at Matthew. How did his face change? In verse 2, his face shone like what? That's how it changed. It didn't turn into a female face. It didn't, you know, turn into some other nationality. It wasn't somebody else's face. It just was his face. But it was shining like the sun. And then also, so a circle, his face shone like the sun in Matthew's column. And then, in verse 2 of Matthew, his garments became as white as what? Well, as light. So circle that. Garments became white as light in Matthew's column. Because all Luke said was it became white and gleaming. Anybody here have any white clothing on? Don's got a white sweater on. Can you have gleaming clothes? Sure, I got a shimmery silver suit. You've all seen it. Doesn't have sequins exactly, but it kind of shines a little bit, you know, that material. Okay? But is it white as light? You know, they're different ideas. And then, circle in Mark's column, all of verse 3, as well, it doesn't really add all that much. It is a little different description. His garments became radiant and exceedingly white, as no launderer on earth can whiten them. He just wanted to emphasize this is a supernatural event. It's not exaggeration. This was not, you know, a robe, a toga, like we would think, that happened to be so purely white. This particular animal it was made out of, or the lugger or whatever, you know, they were really astonishing. No, it's gleaming. It's like the sun, and no launderer can do this. So in these different pieces, you're told this is a miracle. Now we'll close. We've got about 30 seconds here. With Luke's column, 30. Behold, two men were talking with him, and they were Moses and Elijah. What do you see in Luke's column? Two more verses, 31 and 32. What do you see in Mark's column and Matthew's column? Nothing. So what are you going to circle? The only thing is there, 31 and 32, Luke's the only one who said, Moses and Elijah, who appearing in glory, were speaking of his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now, Peter and his companions had been overcome with sleep, but when they were fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men standing with him. Nobody else said those things in that way. So he circled that material. Now, we have the stage set for next week. What happened next?